Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer by turning to the Book of Psalms, saying these inspired songs teach us how to speak to God. Doing business, doing good. Can profitability and ethics successfully coexist? We find out about this and other related issues by talking to a participant at the recent conference in the Vatican on business ethics. Bearing the brunt, as the UN marks World Refugee Day this week, we hear from the Jesuit Refugee Service about the plight of the world's displaced and how it is the poorest nations that are bearing the brunt of this crisis, with 4 out of 5 refugees being hosted in developing countries. And Indonesia, awakening the world's conscience. It rarely makes the international headlines, but more than 200 Christian churches in Indonesia have been attacked in the past 5 years. And we explore why the nation's Christian community is being targeted in this way. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on Christian prayer by turning to the Book of Psalms, saying these inspired songs teach us how to speak to God. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
An extraordinary book of prayers in which God himself teaches Christians how to turn to him. This is how Pope Benedict XVI described the Book of Psalms, the focus of his General Audience Catechesis Wednesday, as he continued his series of lessons on Christian prayer.
Dear brothers and sisters, in our Catechesis on Christian prayer, we have looked to a number of Old Testament figures who represent models of prayer. We now turn to the great prayer book of Sacred Scripture, the Book of Psalms. These inspired songs teach us how to speak to God, expressing ourselves in the whole range of our human experience with words that God himself has given us. Despite the diversity of their literary forms, the Psalms are generally marked by the two interconnected dimensions of humble petition and of praise addressed to a loving God who understands our human frailty.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict added, "In these prayers, the Psalms are manifestations of the soul and faith, in which everyone can recognize and communicate the experience of a special closeness to God, to which every man is called."
In Hebrew, the Psalms are called Tehillim, or songs of praise. The prayer of praise is, in fact, our best response to the God, who even at times of trial remains ever at our side. Many of the Psalms attributed to David, the great king of Israel, who as the Lord's anointed, prefigured the Messiah. In Jesus Christ and his Paschal mystery, the Psalms find their deepest meaning and prophetic fulfillment. Christ himself prayed in their words. As we take up these inspired songs of praise, let us ask the Lord to teach us to pray with him and in him to our Heavenly Father.
Pater noster, sanctificetur.
Finally, Pope Benedict greeted all the English-speaking pilgrims present at the Wednesday audience.
Upon all English-speaking pilgrims, especially those from England, Scotland, Sweden, Indonesia, and the United States, I invoke God's abundant blessings.
Before imparting his apostolic blessing on all those present in St. Peter's Square this Wednesday. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Money. Can business and ethics successfully coexist? In what ways can the financial world implement the principles of Pope Benedict's latest encyclical in their workplaces? And how can the financial world, especially banks, combine the logic of profitability with moral integrity in investments? These were just some of the many points under discussion at an international summit on business ethics held in the Vatican this month. Organised jointly by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace and the Fidelis International Institute, the summit was attended by dozens of business leaders of global institutions and representatives of the Church. The summit in the Vatican also coincided with the upcoming second anniversary of the release of Pope Benedict's encyclical on social and economic issues, Caritas in Veritate, who wrote that every economic decision has a moral consequence. Business ethics is an issue that came under the critical glare of the world's media when the global financial crisis erupted in 2008. An inquiry commission in the US concluded that the crisis was caused by widespread failures in financial regulations, excessive borrowing and risk-taking, particularly in the banking sector, and systematic breaches in accountability and ethics at all levels. One of those attending the conference in the Vatican was Arsenio Rodriguez, executive coordinator of the Alliance for a New Humanity, an international network of people aiming to build a just, peaceful and sustainable world.
Okay, tell us briefly about what are the main aims of this alliance. Is this a new way of doing business or of teaching people how to do business?
No, it's basically a group of people from all walks of life, which includes businessmen, but also academicians and Peace Nobel Prize winners and philosophers that have come together to try to look at the world from a multi-stakeholder angle. So rather than be focused on guilds dealing with the economists, always meet the economists, the lawyers, always meet the lawyers, we want to bring together the human family from all of its vocations to address the issues of modernity. What are we going to do? How can we create a better world? How can we inspire others to come together as a human family?
And how can this help to, in the case of this particular summit, bring more ethics into the business world, into the financial world?
Well, because I think that ethics in reality has to do with the understanding of, like, what's said in the encyclical letter, Caritas et Veritate, that it's all one life. The book of life says beautifully, said the book of life is only one. Everything is interconnected. So unless you appreciate the fact that our human fate, our common future is linked to the other, then our behavior, which is what ethics is all about, is going to affect the others. The more you can accept the unity of mankind, which is a basic Christian principle, the more you can act in coherence with that. It's basically what we are trying to do is promote the idea that we are one family. We have become a much more aware now through science and understanding of the basic principles that, for example, Christianity has been postulating throughout. The fact that we are one human race, that we are all connected, that we are all living in this beautiful world which is given to us as a gift, and we have to take care of it and of ourselves and the other.
You talk about this interconnectivity, and of course, we've just coming out of this global financial crisis, and that was a prime case of seeing how mistakes made in some sector had an impact on basically the whole world. I mean, have we learned the lessons from that? Because, you know, that was blamed on poor financial regulations, you know, excessive risk-taking, excessive borrowing. Do you think we have learned the lessons, or do we run the risk of another crisis coming along?
I think I can only answer to you that I have 4 children and 5 grandchildren, and I've seen them all starting to walk. And it's a hard thing to walk. You always fall down, but you learn to walk by falling down. I think that every one of these crises teaches a lesson, and I think that there's some guidance that we need to accept that goes beyond us. And that is always with us. And that guidance, which in Christianity and in many other religions is called God, is always with us. So I believe that no matter how many times we fall, we will stand up and walk again. I think that that one crisis in particular is not enough. I think that there's a little bit more deeper reflection that is needed, because not everybody is at the same level of awareness that is required to understand that we are all one family and that we need to behave differently, unfortunately.
And can profitability and ethics happily coexist in a business environment, in your view?
Yeah, of course, because profitability, the answer is profitability for what? What are you going to do with the profits? Profitability is different from wealth. Wealth is what you create when you create a happy society, when you create social capital, when you create a fabric of what human life is supposed to be about, is to celebrate life. Profitability is you make money. Money is not the objective. Making money is not the objective of business. That's the duty of a business, is to make money. The objective of business is to create well-being, social well-being, through money. Money is energy. So the more you create profits and you invest this profit in creating social capital, that's fine. But create profit in order to, let's say, go to Las Vegas or hoard the money in your account, what are you going to do with that? That is absolutely selfish, and it goes against you, against your wealth, because you cannot do business in a world that is collapsing.
Because we've seen that, you know, the rich have got richer and the poor have got poorer, so yes. Something's not working.
Exactly. Actually, what is not working is there. It's the ethical. That's the basic principle of understanding that we are all one family. Because how can you be happy? How can you have more than what you need while others have nothing? I think that the basic principle of gratuity, which gratuitousness, which is expressed in the encyclical letter, is precisely that. To share is the greatest treasure that we can have. Love is a treasure that is grows when you share it. It's contrary to money. People think that money is a treasure that you don't share because you won't lose it. But love, which is the principle that keeps us all together, grows when you share it. So that's what charity is all about.
What for you were some of the most insightful phrases or content of this encyclical and how it can be applied to the business world?
Well, I think that for me, the oneness principle, the fact that life, the book of life is one, there's one nature, I mean, how are we connected? The principle of reciprocity and gratuitousness, which demands the recognition of this greater force, love. It's all about love. Love is what keeps us together. And when you are divorced from that thinking, when you are not aware of that, that you are part of this beautiful world and celebration, then you become ignorant and you try to possess things for only your ego, for your, all yourself, and you are isolated and you create lots of problems for the common good. So that's basically what I feel.
I was speaking to Arsenio Rodriguez of the Alliance for New Humanity. Benedict says refugees deserve a dignified welcome from countries receiving them until they can return home freely and safely. The Pope's remarks came during his visit to the tiny republic of San Marino in central Italy on the eve of World Refugee Day and the 60th anniversary of the 1951 Refugee Convention. A UN report issued to mark this event says the number of people forced to flee their homes to escape war or abuse has risen to its highest level for 15 years. But according to the UN, it's the world's poorer countries that are bearing the burden of this growing crisis, with 4 out of 5 refugees hosted in developing nations. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees referred to this uneven distribution of the world's displaced and urged all states not to close their borders to people seeking protection. James Stapleton is the International Communications Coordinator for the Jesuit Refugee Service, which is at the forefront of helping millions of displaced men, women and children worldwide. He told us more about the ongoing plight of refugees in some of the more overlooked corners of the globe and spoke of the growing anti-refugee sentiment in some Western nations.
In 60 years, what has been done to try and ensure the rights of refugees?
Well, I think you mean, when you talk about what's been done, you've got to look at the millions of people around the world who, without the Geneva Convention, without the Refugee Convention, wouldn't have received the protection that they need. We can think of Kosovo, we can think of Bosnia, we can think of the people who fled Rwanda. There are numerous places that one can go around the world. We can think of Libya, which is today thousands of people fleeing conflict who are finding protection in Tunisia, primarily Tunisia and Egypt. Without the Geneva Convention, there would be no obligation on states to provide protection, and it would be up to the states to decide on an ad hoc basis to whether or not they wanted to protect this group of individuals. And what we find is when states are not parties to the convention, then sometimes political expediency becomes more important, if you like, than the need to protect human life.
Which is something that we're seeing unfolding, of course, in the situation with Syria. But you mentioned there the situation with North African migrants and refugees, particularly refugees who are fleeing the conflict that is still ongoing 3 months later in Libya. Many of these men, women and children are crossing the Mediterranean Sea or trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea and are seeking asylum in countries like Italy, like Malta, like Cyprus. The Jesuit Refugee Service is on the ground in these places.
We have projects, obviously, throughout Italy, particularly in Catania and Palermo, but also in other cities like Rome. When people arrive into Lampedusa, what first happens is they're identified, and then, as possible, the government moves them on to other sites where they can receive, as we saw in the initial stages, they can receive temporary protection when we're talking about the Tunisians. But now when we talk about people, particularly sub-Saharan Africans who are desperately trying to get out of Libya because it's extremely dangerous, we've heard reports from what's happening in Libya where people are being randomly targeted, where people are terrified and too afraid to leave their homes. And now they're trying to get over the ocean. We're extremely happy that those who have arrived have been received and they're now going through the process. In Malta, it's a particularly difficult situation. One can imagine that the population of Malta is only 400,000, and as yet, as far as we know, there are 2,000 people who have arrived into Malta. A huge percentage of them have already been granted protection. The Maltese reception centres are overflowing. The Maltese detention centres are full. And what we will be calling on now is other European states to help Malta out. The Frances, the Germanys, the United Kingdoms, the larger states who have plenty of capacity to protect, but up until now have been reluctant to do so. The same thing goes for Italy. For people who have arrived, the situation has been what we're hearing has been good. It's hard. The Italian state has been slow to put in the structures. The big concern that we're facing at the moment is what we need for European states to provide a humanitarian, what they say in Italian, humanitarian canal to get out. We know over the next number of months more people will try to flee. We know the waters are a little bit calmer at the moment, but we also know from past experiences that means that many people will die unless European states act, and act in the next few weeks to do what they can to get people out that they know are in need of international protection. We know from the experiences these people are coming from Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, states which produce large numbers of refugees, and we know as they try to get across the water, these are people who need international protection.
You speak of a canal, the creation of a canal to try and get these people out. You're speaking of this filtering system from Italy into these other larger European states.
We're talking about people who are leaving Libya. We're talking about sending boats out to make sure that they safely arrive into Europe. We're talking about humanitarian evacuation of people where we can get access to, and we know that they're in need of international protection. We have contacts on the ground. Things can be done. We've seen humanitarian evacuations take place in the past. The largest one that we can get up was Kosovo. The international community has the capacity and the obligation to act to make sure that we prevent further loss of life.
You speak of the obligation, the duty, the moral duty on the part of many of the players in the developed nations to do their fair share for these people fleeing violence, fleeing persecution. They're not merely seeking a better life. They are actually leaving their countries for a reason when we speak about refugees and asylum seekers. So what does a story like the current situation in Australia, how does that affect Jesuit Refugee Service, where you have boatloads of people, many of them are refugees from countries such as Afghanistan and other countries of conflict in that area of the world, who really take on a very perilous journey and cross thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of ocean only to be turned back to countries like Malaysia, who aren't signatories of the Geneva Convention?
We're extremely surprised and worried, should I say worried and upset about what's happening at the moment. Australia, Europe, the United States, this is happening again and again, and it's increasingly happening. And not only as it starts to happen in developing world, as you can imagine, as the developed world shirks its responsibilities towards refugees, then it's the message to other weaker states who accept much larger refugee flows to do the same. What's happening in Australia at the moment is a huge disappointment for a nation with such a respectable tradition of providing protection to people fleeing conflict and other forms of human rights abuses. We would urge the Australian government to rethink that. The number of arrivals into Australia at the moment are extremely small. Sending people back to nations like Malaysia, who are known to put people in indefinite protection, to arbitrarily return them to places of where they may fear serious human rights abuses is absolutely unacceptable. But it's not just happening, unfortunately, in Australia. It's also happening in the United States. The United States intercepts on the high seas Haitians who are fleeing and other nationalities who are fleeing and sends them back without an opportunity to apply for asylum. And what's happening now in Europe at the moment, right under our very noses, is with accusations that states have failed to respond to calls for rescue. States like Italy and Malta getting involved in unseemly arguments about whose responsibility it is to save a boat that they know is in danger of sinking. This is a really, really negative message that they're sending out to other states. One would just think of states like Kenya, South Africa. South Africa's got the largest number of registered asylum seekers in the world. Now, if states like Italy, which is part of the G8, starts to refuse and starts to shirk its responsibility towards people in such horrendous situations, what message are they sending out to states who have to host hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers and refugees on their territory with much, much less resources to be able to meet those needs?
That was James Stapleton of the Jesuit Refugee Service talking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. Really makes the international headlines, but more than 200 Christian churches in Indonesia have been attacked in the past 5 years. A recent report submitted to the Catholic charity Aid to the Church in Need by the president of the Jakarta Christian Community Forum showed that 14 churches were attacked in the first 5 months of this year. So why is the small Christian community in Indonesia being targeted in this way? To find out more about the background to these attacks, Lydia Kane spoke to John Pontifex, press officer for Aid to the Church in Need.
The focus of the report that we've received from Theophilus Bela, who's the president of the Jakarta Christian Community Forum out in Indonesia, the basis of what he's saying is that the president, Susilo Bambang, has failed to do enough to crack down on the Islamists and other insurgents who are causing the problems against Christians and indeed general instability in the region as well. And he accuses the president of, quote, sleeping if there is an attack on Christian churches. He goes on to say, if the president sleeps, so do the police. So it's a broadside attack on the government for failing to take this matter seriously, and thereby only encouraging the action of this nature to continue.
Why are Christians being targeted?
The focus for that is that what we see is over the course of the last few years is that over time, a lot of people out in the villages have come into the centre of the cities in Indonesia. And these centres have been largely populated by Muslim communities, and a lot of the people coming into them are Christians. And the local indigenous community, if you like, are unhappy about that. And so it is understood that that has caused a certain amount of friction, and they've taken it out on these outsiders, as they perceive them, who they see to be Christian. That's one aspect of it. The other is that it does seem that Islamist figures and other sympathizers are growing in profile, and we know that there are Islamists on the rise in that neck of the woods. All of that part of Indonesia has seen a rise in Islamist activity So that is a real problem. And of course, there is the famous Islamist Abu Bakr Bashir, who of course is accused of masterminding the attacks on the churches in Indonesia, and also who was convicted for conspiracy for the 2002 Bali bombings, if you remember. But of course, that was overturned subsequently in Indonesia's Supreme Court. So there are those factors that account for the rise of these actions against the church.
What effect is this having on the Christian community? I mean, is there a very real fear factor now?
Well, Theophilus does go into that. He does speak about how the Christians are responding. Because, of course, what you're dealing with is a very large community of Christians, that you've got a 28.5 million Christian community. But he says that it's partly perhaps because of their number. I quote him as he says, "We Christians are not afraid because we are also citizens of this country like other groups of our society. Christians go to their churches," he goes on to say, "regularly. And our churches are always full every Sunday." And, of course, they take great pride in the fact that, of course, the country has a pluralistic ideology and that there's no actual state religion. So for those reasons, the Christians are not in any way cowed by this activity. And it's also said that the Christians have staged protests against the president by holding religious services on two Sundays in front of his state palace only just recently. So theirs is a bullish strong-willed approach, and it's full credit to them, because if you have that sort of level of oppression against you, it would be very understandable were you to be reduced to a position of fear and of disappearing from the public eye.
So that was one of the questions I was going to actually ask you about Christians and how they were responding, in the sense of, are they speaking out? And you've answered that, certainly in the fact that they are holding protests. But I suppose the other question would be, are other people willing to listen?
Well, that's a really, really good question to ask, Lydia, because at Aid to the Church in Need, our primary concern is to awaken the world's conscience to the fact that the church in different parts of the world is under attack. It's not comprehensive, it's not happening everywhere, it's not happening to alarmingly increased degrees, but it is on the rise. And if you look at this single report here from Indonesia, we'll see that, okay, in the first 5 months of 2011, we've only had 14 attacks, whereas in the whole of last year, we had 46. So that would indicate a downturn. But if you take the position overall, since the 1960s, the attacks have increased dramatically. And what we are seeing is that pattern replicated to a greater or less degree in many parts of the Muslim world. And it's time that we, particularly as Christians, recognize that the plight of our brothers and sisters in Christ is a plight that's worsening, that's deepening, and that it's beholden upon us to respond, both in prayer and in action. So the principal factor of response is to inform. So people need to really feel it's their responsibility to learn about these things and to understand them, and from there to react and to support those organizations, not least Aid to the Church in Need, that it's helping the church that's persecuted.
That was John Pontifex from the charity Aid to the Church in Need, speaking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.